oxygen treatment that could be about to be approved. First, we'll take a look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases both confirmed and probable, 7,588. Ector County negative, 28,857 out of 36,900 tested, with 455 pending, 124 deaths. Recovered, 5,936. Active, 1,528. ECISD daily cases, 28 students, 16 staff. Midland County, 6,024 confirmed cases with 101 deaths. And the MISD has updated their COVID homepage. They're reporting now total confirmed cases, 447, cases in November, 117. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 1,088 cases compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 9th, 3,816 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 333 patients compared with a week ago. As of November 9th, 6,103 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths increased by 13 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On November 9th, 26 new deaths were reported in Texas. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $41.09, and that's up 8 cents. First, here are coronavirus briefs. The United States topped 10 million coronavirus cases on Monday, the sixth consecutive day with a six-figure increase in infections. But the news that Pfizer's experimental coronavirus vaccine is more than 90% effective offered a glimmer of hope that some Americans could be immunized before the end of the year. The Supreme Court on Tuesday will review the latest Republican challenge to the Affordable Care Act. The Food and Drug Administration gave emergency authorization to an antibody treatment that can prevent people with mild coronavirus cases from developing severe symptoms, but supplies are limited. We'll have more on that in a few moments. Brazil has suspended clinical trials of China's experimental coronavirus vaccine, health regulator Anvisa said Monday, citing a serious adverse event. Nearly 119,000 new coronavirus cases were reported Monday in the United States, as two-thirds of the state set records for the 7-day rolling average for new cases. The count of fatalities stands at approximately 238,000. Before we get to our short articles, I'm going to read this afternoon, a Facebook post that was shared by a friend of mine. I ordinarily wouldn't read Facebook posts, but given the source, the topicality, and the locality of this post, I feel obliged to read this to you, which will give us some insight into what's going on at the hospital in Midland. This post is by Heather Hughes Bredemus. My husband, Dr. Kit Bredemus, Chief Nursing Officer of Midland Memorial Hospital, spoke at the City Council this morning about the state of our hospital and the health of our community. Please read his speech below. Thank you, Mayor and City Council, for this opportunity. I would also like to thank you for your support in expanding our testing capability. My name is Dr. Kit Bredemus, and I am the Chief Nursing Officer at Midland Memorial Hospital. Having grown up in Midland, I have seen this community go through some pretty significant events. I have been on the front lines as an emergency room nurse for over a decade. In that time, I have been through the swine flu, SARS, Ebola, as well as every other disaster to hit our city. What we are experiencing now with COVID-19 is unlike anything I have ever seen. Since the onset of COVID, we have had to request over 100 outside nurses to help battle this problem, and an additional 40 nurses requested from the state and federal agencies. If it were not for the state sending in disaster resources, we would have already been forced to shut down many critical operations this community depends on. Today, we have 81 COVID patients in the hospital. We only have 14 invasive ventilators left for use. This week, we are opening a new floor to try to accommodate more and more of our own patients. Less than 18% of our COVID population is from out of county, and that number is declining as we have been closed to various transfers for weeks. Our testing was over 30% positivity rate last week, a significant increase from the prior week. Our COVID hospitalization rate is hovering around 30%, double what is considered a high population rate. We are desperately trying to source enough equipment and personnel to expand beyond our capacity. I am continually amazed by my team's resilience and adaptability, but we need your help. I am here today to implore the City Council and the Mayor to take a clear and unequivocal stance on the use of masks and other minimum standard health protocols recommended by the Texas Department of State Health Services. Furthermore, I strongly encourage the City Council and the Mayor to put measures in place that, if followed, have been proven to significantly reduce the spread of this virus. I want to make it clear that we healthcare workers are no longer the front lines. We are the last line. The front lines now belong to the community. While the call for personal responsibility has been recommended by Mayor Payton, we are at the mercy of those who choose not to take responsibility. Encouraging responsibility is not working. I continue to see many people in this city blatantly disregard the governor's order to wear masks, social distance, and avoid crowds. What is a minor inconvenience for many is potentially life-saving, as roughly half of COVID transmission is thought to come from asymptomatic individuals. This is not a political issue or a matter of opinion. I am sounding the alarm right now that our healthcare system is becoming overwhelmed, and we are on the same course as El Paso and other hotspots. Even if you are not hospitalized for COVID, this will affect you. Surgeries are being canceled. New moms and babies are not able to have family by their side. If you are in a car accident, have a heart attack, or need to be sent to a higher level of care, every ICU across this region and southern New Mexico is full, including ours. I had to listen from 1,000 miles away as nurses updated me on my mom's deteriorating condition due to COVID. My uncle, who lived in the same house, died just the day before from sudden respiratory failure, but they would not test for COVID postmortem due to limited testing supplies. I am thankful that my mom survived her ICU stay, but I have had to speak to several families in our area who were not as fortunate. The hospital is doing all it can at this point, and the only thing to change the trajectory of this outbreak are the attitudes and behaviors of our city and this council. I am asking all of you to come out with a full-throat endorsement of the governor's executive order for minimum standard health protocols, including required use of masks. I would like to add that our highest number of COVID patients hit its peak this weekend at 72. By this morning, that number rose to 81, and this evening, we hit a new record, with numbers continuing to rise. Less than 12% of those came from out of county. To be clear, the out-of-county patients are not hospital transfers. They are residents from smaller towns surrounding the Permian Basin, desperate for help with no available health care in their area, who drove to MMH. Anyone who walks through our hospital doors cannot be denied health care. The hospital and our health care workers are struggling like never before. Our resources are depleting rapidly, with no sign of when additional resources will arrive. Our family members and friends will soon be shipped across the state when we are no longer to be able to meet the need. If other counties cannot accept our transfers, patients will soon be sharing rooms, some without a monitor. And now that is the end of his speech to the council, and the following is his wife's addendum. The situation is dire. Kit Bredemus and I are asking all of you to take caution. Wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands, do not attend crowded venues, ask businesses to enforce masking. Reach out to your city council representative and Mayor Payton and ask them to enforce the governor's executive order requiring the use of masks. Unfortunately, the future of our city's health care is at the mercy of those who refuse to take personal responsibility. We need local officials to help enforce health protocols that will keep us safe. Please share this post with your family, friends, and district representatives. Now, here are some short articles. Pfizer seeks to reassure that its COVID-19 vaccine is safe and that no corners were cut, from CNN Health's Shelby Lynn Erdman. No corners were cut in the development of Pfizer's two-dose coronavirus vaccine, the company's vice president of research and development, Dr. John Burkhart, said at a news conference in Connecticut Monday. Pfizer has been in the vaccine business for quite a number of years with many products on the market, many also in development for other infectious diseases, Burkhart said. So with this particular vaccine, no corners were cut. We followed this tried and true methodology that has worked so well for us in the past and continues to deliver really superior and safe products, he added. Burkhart said what's been unusual in the development of its COVID-19 vaccine is that the company started the manufacturing process at the same time as it was developing the vaccine, something that is not usually done. Normally, you wouldn't spend $1 billion to manufacture a product that may not work. You wait to see whether it works and whether it's safe, and then you do the manufacturing. So we did that at risk, he said. It was a decision made very early in the process to save time, Burkhart said. He also credited great volunteerism in getting 43,000 people enrolled in the clinical trials as a time saver in the development process. Pfizer announced Monday that early efficacy data on its COVID-19 vaccine appears to be more than 90% effective, much better than expected. Pfizer says 42% of volunteers in COVID-19 vaccine trials are from diverse backgrounds, from CNN Health's Shelby Lynn Erdman. Almost half of the volunteers in Pfizer's Phase 3 clinical trials for a coronavirus vaccine are from diverse backgrounds, the company's vice president of research and development, Dr. John Burkhart, said at a news conference in Connecticut Monday. Our approach has been to really enroll lots of patients, gain lots of diversity in that population, go into the places where we can enroll diversity, and then to learn from that data as it plays out in the study, Burkhart said. Pfizer is studying 43,000 patients in its vaccine trials, he said, and 42% are from ethnic and racial backgrounds that are considered diverse. It's unclear whether the vaccine may not benefit some populations or if there might be side effects associated with it. We don't have the sub-level of detail to answer those, but we believe we've got the kind of clinical trial design and some simple data set that will be very informative, he said. Coronavirus vaccine doses may be available by the end of November. From CNN Health's Lauren Mascarenhas. If Pfizer's coronavirus vaccine is authorized for emergency use, it's very likely people will be receiving doses by the end of this year, Dr. Anthony Fauci said Monday. Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, said he's certain Pfizer will apply for emergency use authorization for its COVID-19 vaccine within the next week and a half or so, which means if that goes along smoothly, that we may have doses that we're able to give people by the end of November, the beginning of December, probably well into December, he told CNN's Wolf Blitzer. Fauci said that all the safety and regulatory checks must be completed. But we would be giving vaccines to people very likely before the end of this year, said Fauci. That is good news. Fauci also said that the last time he spoke to President Donald Trump was when he was hospitalized with coronavirus in early October. U.S. state officials daunted over how to distribute the most fragile vaccine in American history. From CNN's Elizabeth Cohen, John Bonifield, and Sierra Jenkins. State health officials in the U.S. have told CNN that they are feeling overwhelmed and daunted at the prospect of distributing Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine should it be widely available soon. On Monday, Pfizer announced that early data from its Phase 3 trial showed its vaccine was more than 90% effective. The drug giant could apply for authorization from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, as early as this month. The vaccine's handling requirements are stringent. It has to be stored at about minus 75 degrees Celsius, minus 103 degrees Fahrenheit, more than 50 degrees Celsius lower than any other vaccine currently on the market in the U.S. The required conditions are far colder than the temperature in freezers kept in doctors' offices, pharmacies, and public health clinics. Molly Howe, who's in charge of the immunization program in North Dakota, said she felt overwhelmed and daunted while watching a webinar last month on how to distribute Pfizer's vaccine. "How are we going to do this?" she texted a colleague who was also on the webinar. Her colleague responded with an exploding head emoji. Pfizer has offered thermal shippers about the size of a suitcase to keep the vaccine cold. They're only temporary and need to be replenished with dry ice every 5 days. It would be hard to, with a straight face, say, "Oh, we're all set," said Christine Finley, Vermont's immunization program manager. "This equals a challenge I don't think we've ever seen before." And now, related to those previous short articles, here's a pre-recorded report from NPR today. Despite encouraging Pfizer news, widespread vaccination is months away.
All right, two significant numbers having to do with COVID-19. 10 million, that's the number of confirmed cases in the U.S., and it's going up. And 90%, that's how effective Pfizer says its coronavirus vaccine is in preventing symptomatic cases of COVID-19. So does this mean we could have a vaccine soon? NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin is here with a reality check.
The truth is that widespread vaccination is many months away. That may seem strange. Everything about this vaccine has been fast. So why can't we go from promising results to vaccines for all right away? There are a few reasons. The first is that these results are preliminary. Pfizer will gather and present more data on efficacy and safety to the Food and Drug Administration. That's best case a few weeks away. If all looks good, the FDA will authorize it for emergency use so Pfizer can work with the federal government's Operation Warp Speed to start distribution. That is no simple task for this vaccine, partly because it needs to be kept very cold. Here's Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at Columbia University.
Most freezers that we think of as a freezer is a minus 20 degrees Celsius freezer. This requires storage in minus 80 degree or below freezers. So those ultra-cold freezers are not in your neighborhood Walgreens.
Pfizer has created its own specialized storage containers with dry ice to make it a bit easier. Here is the next challenge. Manufacturing has already begun for several vaccine candidates, including Pfizer's, but at first there will still be limited doses, as Army General Gus Perna of Operation Warp Speed told NPR yesterday.
I think by the end of December, somewhere between tens of millions to 30 million doses will be available.
Each person needs two doses. So best case, that's enough for only 4% of the population by the end of the year, although more doses will become available as the months go on. Those doses will get shipped out to public health workers and healthcare providers who need to be ready to receive the super cold vaccine and get it quickly to the right people. And that brings us to the last reason why this is going to take a while. This is not a first-come, first-serve situation. The limited doses will be carefully doled out to different groups like frontline health workers, seniors, those most at risk. So, says Rasmussen,
it's not as though vaccine is available and suddenly the clouds part and the sun comes out and everything is just wonderful. This is going to be a process that takes many months, and we're still going to have to be vigilant in the meantime about reducing community transmission.
That means there's no getting away from social distancing or hand washing or wearing masks anytime soon. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News.
And now this short article. Nearly 10,000 coronavirus patients return to the hospital within 2 months of discharge, says the CDC, by the Washington Post's Antonia Farzan. Nearly 10,000 patients admitted to U.S. hospitals for the coronavirus between March and July were readmitted to the same hospital within 2 months of their release, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That amounts to nearly 10% of all hospitalized patients, adding to the growing body of evidence that suggests that even people who technically recover from COVID-19 may continue to struggle with complications long after the fact. Published in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report, the study is based on records from 126,137 coronavirus patients. About 15% died while hospitalized, leaving 106,543 survivors. By August, 9,504 of those survivors had been readmitted to the same facility in the 2 months following their discharge. The researchers found that people 65 and older were more likely to be readmitted, as were those with chronic health conditions such as diabetes or kidney disease. Patients who were discharged to a skilled nursing facility or the care of a home health aide, or who had been hospitalized in the 3 months leading up to their diagnosis, were also more likely to be readmitted. Although people of color have been disproportionately affected by the virus, the report found that white people were more likely to be readmitted than other racial and ethnic groups. Diseases affecting the circulatory, digestive, or respiratory systems were the most common diagnoses for patients who required hospitalization again, the study says. In the future, researchers plan to look more closely at readmission data to better understand the long-term effects of the coronavirus and identify long-term symptoms that require ongoing care. The study has some notable limitations. As the researchers acknowledge, it does not account for people who received care at a different hospital after their initial treatment, or those who experience long-term symptoms but are not readmitted to the hospital. And along those lines, as well as the initial speech from MMH's chief nursing officer, here's an NPR story from today that relates. COVID-19 hospitalizations are surging. Where are hospitals reaching capacity?
One sign that the United States is in a coronavirus surge, hospitalizations around the country have nearly doubled since late September. Some hospitals are already talking about rationing care. Will Stone has more.
Back in the spring, Dr. William Melms was watching the surge of COVID patients in New York City and readying his hospitals in Wisconsin to endure the same.
We waited and waited. It did not come.
About 6 months later, it has arrived. Melms is the chief medical officer at the Marshfield Clinic Health System, which covers mostly rural Wisconsin.
We will be pushed to the limit by the end of the month.
COVID patients are filling up their beds at an unsustainable rate. And because so many parts of Wisconsin and the Midwest are under siege, Melms says there are not many places they can turn to, either to send their patients or to get extra staff.
Creating the manpower to take care of our patients is the dilemma. You know, we don't have any areas to decompress. We don't have safety valves to put our patients.
This is the message coming from more hospitals in more states every day. For weeks, the U.S. coronavirus pandemic has shattered records. In the wake of those sky-high numbers come hospitalizations. Lauren Sauer studies hospital capacity at Johns Hopkins University.
We have legitimate reason to be very, very concerned about our health system at a national level.
That's because this surge could wash over many places simultaneously. In at least 18 states, COVID patients account for more than 10% of all hospitalizations.
Above that 10% is where we really think, okay, perhaps we have to start enacting surge strategies and crisis standards of care in some places.
Crisis standards of care, a broad term for how hospitals make decisions around treatment when resources are limited. In the worst-case scenarios, it can lead to rationing of care. Some states, including Utah, have recently warned this could be on the horizon. Masheed Abir is an emergency physician and researcher at the University of Michigan in the RAND Corporation. If there are many epicenters, Abir says it will be much harder to shuffle around resources because everyone will be overwhelmed.
So it's space, staff, and stuff. And you need all three. And if you don't have one, it doesn't matter if you have the other two.
And most U.S. hospitals already don't have much cushion. They usually run close to capacity, especially during flu season. Then on top of that, add COVID patients who can require lots more time and care, and it strains the system.
This is a scarce resource. Critical care nurses are scarce. Ventilators are scarce, as you know. Respiratory therapists are scarce.
And she worries about to become even more scarce. For NPR News, I'm Will Stone.
And finally, here's an article that's rather lengthy, so I won't be reading all of it, but in the few minutes that remain, I'll read the portion that we have time for. FDA authorizes Eli Lilly antibody drug that Trump touted, but supply will be limited, by the Washington Post's Carolyn Y. Johnson. The first COVID-19 treatment to protect people with mild illness from developing severe disease was granted emergency use authorization by regulators Monday evening. The drug, a laboratory-brewed antibody that imitates the immune system's attack on the virus, is made by Eli Lilly and Company. Health experts have championed the class of medicine as a powerful tool to change the course of the pandemic and work as a bridge to a vaccine. It is in the same family of medication as an experimental treatment President Trump received when he was stricken with COVID-19, the illness the novel coronavirus causes. But the initial scarcity of the drug and the logistical complexities of administering it could mute its immediate impact on the pandemic and raises questions about whether it is being distributed to people in the greatest need. The drug, bamlanivimab, must be delivered by intravenous infusion early in the illness. It was authorized for use in patients with mild or moderate cases of the coronavirus who are at high risk of severe disease or hospitalization. Risk factors include being older than 65, diabetes, obesity with different body mass index cutoffs depending on age, a suppressed immune system, and cardiovascular disease or high blood pressure in people over the age of 55. Bamlanivimab, when given early in the disease course, may help patients clear the virus and reduce COVID-related hospitalizations, supporting our belief that neutralizing antibodies can be an important therapeutic option for patients fighting this virus, Daniel Skovronsky, Eli Lilly's chief scientific officer, said in a statement. The FDA remains committed to expediting the development and availability of potential COVID-19 treatments and providing sick patients timely access to new therapies where appropriate, while at the same time supporting research to further evaluate whether they are safe and effective, FDA Commissioner Stephen M. Hahn said in a statement. Emergency use authorization is a mechanism to provide access to an unapproved treatment when the known and potential benefits outweigh the risk. Now the formidable mechanics of delivering the drugs to people loom. The number of doses available will be dwarfed by soaring need, with more than 500,000 coronavirus cases counted over the past week alone. By the end of the year, Lilly projects 1 million doses could be available. The United States has negotiated contracts for 300,000 of those doses. This treatment and others like it will help protect the health and well-being of millions of vulnerable Americans until a safe and effective vaccine is approved for use, White House spokesman Michael Barrs said in a statement. But physicians raised concerns about whether there would be enough doses and whether distribution would be given to those in greatest need. There is a real concern of inequitable distribution. Unless we are very thoughtful about ensuring that facilities to administer the treatment are in disadvantaged communities, said Douglas White, a critical care physician and medical ethicist at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. We've already seen that testing centers for COVID are disproportionately in wealthier areas of towns and cities, and that introduces an inequity. If the same thing were to happen with treatment centers with the monoclonal antibodies, it would be deeply ethically problematic. The drugs must be given in lengthy infusions, and the network of emergency rooms or clinics that will provide them is not clear, particularly because patients will be contagious and can't get them alongside patients with cancer or autoimmune diseases at established infusion clinics without infection control. A government document on payment policy released last month mentions that providers could give the drugs in temporary expansion sites, such as an erected tent, a retrofitted convention center, or the beneficiary's home. One of the questions will be equity, creating a platform where these drugs can be delivered in areas where there aren't big hospitals, like Boston, said Naheed Bradilia, an infectious disease expert at Boston University School of Medicine. Because most people recover from COVID-19 without serious symptoms, giving the drugs to people broadly could waste a precious resource, and the FDA warned that in severely ill patients who require high-flow oxygen or are on a ventilator, the drug may be linked to worse outcomes. A test of Eli Lilly's drug in hospitalized patients was discontinued after an interim analysis found the drug was unlikely to have benefit. Through Operation Warp Speed, the Trump administration effort to speed up treatments and vaccines, the government has bought 300,000 doses each from Eli Lilly and Regeneron at a cost of about $1,250 and $1,500 per dose, respectively. Government health officials said they will allocate those doses free of charge, following a strategy similar to what is used for remdesivir, an antiviral drug administered to hospitalized patients. Each state will receive an allotment based on an algorithm that evaluates confirmed coronavirus cases over the previous week. Then the states will select administration sites, and wholesaler AmerisourceBergen will distribute the drug, probably for use in emergency rooms or special clinics. And that's all the time that we have for today, so we'll end this article at this point. But here's a quick look at what's coming up. Coming up next, to get us up to 2 o'clock, we'll bring you a health publication. And then at 2, national news from the USA Today, followed at 3 o'clock with local news. And here are some of the stories our volunteers are reading today. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, Dixon says Midlanders need total mindset shift on academic performance. Jump in prices greeted with celebration and caution. Jurgen said there's life after COVID-19 for the industry. And local Democrats react to Biden's win. From the Odessa American, COVID concerns remain high. Landgraf files House Bill 103 to create active shooter alert system. And juveniles prosecution on agenda. Commissioners also hear Gallivan's plan for child protective services. Those articles and more coming up at 3 o'clock for our 2-hour local news broadcast. At 6, more national news from the USA Today, and we will be back at 1 tomorrow afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us today. Be safe. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, USA Today, followed by the Midland Reporter-Telegram and Odessa American at 3.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
Hello, and welcome to our program. My name is Penae McBride, and I will be reading Women's Health here on Sight into Sound Radio. Today's first article comes from the Shape Magazine Special Edition on immunity for fall and winter of 2020. Immune health and COVID-19. We've learned to wash our hands regularly and cook at home more. The impact on sleep and exercise, not ideal. In the months that Melody Lehrman, a contract recruiter in Stamford, Connecticut, has been home full-time because of COVID-19, her health behaviors have changed dramatically. Hour-long walks with her dog have fallen by the wayside, and she's often been up past midnight, snacking and checking her phone. On the plus side, Lehrman, who's 43, has also kept some healthy habits, including sneaking veggies into family meals, such as mixing chopped kale or spinach into meatballs and burgers. She's also been spending more time outside with her 9-year-old daughter, Amber, to keep their bodies moving, and in the spring bought a paddleboard and kayak for family outings. When Lehrman attended a small in-person yoga class and it made her feel better mentally and physically, she vowed to keep it up, and has. I wanted to carve out an hour a week for myself to continue doing it and going forward. Like Lehrman, most of us have adopted new behaviors to fight COVID-19 that could impact immune health, for better and for worse. On one hand, people out of necessity are cooking at home, a shift that could benefit immune health and lead to reductions in chronic diet-related illnesses like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. They have also adopted hand washing, a practice that can help prevent the transmission of the flu and common cold, and have been sensitized to the effects of sneezing and breathing on other people. At the same time, with many gym closures in the early months of the shutdown and social distancing rules in place, about a third of Americans report that they're exercising less than before the pandemic, and experts worry that reversing the trend could be difficult. Sleep patterns have been turned upside down, with people sleeping longer but less restfully, according to one study. Reports of stress and loneliness are spiking, which can also weaken the immune system and increase vulnerability, not only to COVID-19, but to the flu, the common cold, and other diseases. All of this is concerning because it not only impacts our day-to-day health, but also how we live our lives going forward, including the ways we can make our lives safer in future pandemics, says Mark Moyad, MD, MPH, the Jenkins Polk Kempner Director of Preventive and Alternative Medicine at the University of Michigan Medical School. It's very early in the cycle of the disease and hard to say with any certainty what the long-term health impact will be. But experts are worried about unexpected consequences, such as changes in levels of vitamin D from staying indoors more. A recent research paper found that the European populations with the highest death rates from COVID-19 such as Spain and Italy, have lower levels of vitamin D. There are vitamin D receptors on white blood cells, so it makes sense that higher levels of vitamin D may optimize the body's immune response to COVID-19, says David Katz, MD, MPH, the founding director of Yale University's Griffin Prevention Research Center. Recommended amounts can vary from 600 international units a day to 1,000 or more. You should talk to your doctor if you have concerns. If history is any guide, the current pandemic could lead to permanent changes in behavior. In the 1890s, the War on Tuberculosis public health campaign made cup sharing and public spitting things of the past. As American cities during that time slowly began to realize that urine and feces contributed to outbreaks of tuberculosis, cholera, and typhoid, government officials began promoting indoor water closets, or the first toilets, and chlorinating the water supply. Builders even began adding porches and windows to houses in order to increase ventilation to prevent illnesses. During the 1918 flu pandemic, public health authorities created posters to promote hand washing and educate people about the effects of coughing and sneezing. They also, like now, encouraged people to wear face coverings in public to prevent the spread of potentially infectious droplets. More recently, SARS changed Hong Kong, which helped it prepare for COVID. Once the coronavirus emerged there, the region moved quickly to institute social distancing guidelines, from work-from-home schedules and face masks. Hand sanitizer became ubiquitous in stores around the country, as did temperature checks and health questionnaires. So it should come as no surprise that less than a year into the pandemic, we're already seeing the effects of behaviors that can impact immune health. Case in point, exercise. We all know how important staying active is. People who exercise at least 5 days a week had more than 40% fewer sick days than those who were more sedentary. And Americans, in the best of times, are notorious couch potatoes. Now there's evidence people aren't getting the minimum of moderate and vigorous activity or the twice-weekly strength training that they need. In fact, the most active Americans report exercising a third less during the COVID-19 pandemic, according to a study of more than 3,000 American adults published in the research publication platform Cambridge Open Engage. A study published in June in the Annals of Internal Medicine found that daily step counts dropped all over the world during the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. This is troubling news, especially since about a third of all current gym goers reported plans to cancel their memberships during the pandemic. Since more people now are working from home, they also tend to be more sedentary, says Dr. Moyad. And with gyms closed, they're not necessarily thinking about alternatives like exercising outdoors or online workout videos. The news on the sleep front isn't good either. While we're sleeping up to 50 minutes longer, for many people, sleep quality has deteriorated, according to a June 2020 study published in the journal Current Biology. Your immune system is like your computer. It needs moments of rest so it doesn't become overheated, says Dr. Moyad. Sleep is a way to essentially reboot it. When you're sleep deprived, he adds, your body churns out stress hormones, such as cortisol, to keep you awake and alert, which in turn can also suppress your immune system. Then there's not the inconsiderable stress caused by COVID, from staying indoors, family tension, loss of income, and instability, all of which can suppress your immune system. A recent survey from the American Psychological Association's Annual Stress in America shows that about 70% of Americans report significant stress due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Stress levels were particularly high among parents of children under age 18, who cited distance learning, as well as access to food, housing, and health care as among their most major concerns. When you're that anxious, all the habits of healthy living that help boost the immune system, eating right, exercising, sleeping, connecting with others, fall by the wayside, says Bruce Rabin, MD, PhD, Professor Emeritus of Preventive Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. Some employers are getting ahead of the game, with companies like 3M offering weekly virtual and in-person 30-minute mindfulness sessions, and others like Citibank hosting online fitness classes and virtual private training sessions. And employees isolating at their home can incorporate activities on their own. Even housework helps. All those basic household chores, such as sweeping, vacuuming, gardening, dusting, washing windows, ironing, making beds, doing laundry, washing dishes, stair climbing, can potentially make up for some fitness deficits, says Dr. Moyad. All of these activities should confer similar immunity benefits as you'd get from working out at a gym, he explains. One upside is diet. In spite of the so-called quarantine 15, more than 1 in 10 adults surveyed say their diet has improved, according to a recent Gallup poll. A notable place of change has been in the kitchen. A survey published in April by the consumer marketing firm Hunter found that 54% of the American public reported cooking more, with almost half wanting to find ways to cook healthier. Half reported feeling more confident in the kitchen, while about a third said they enjoy cooking more than ever. Almost 40% said they were eating healthier foods. Best of all, 51% vowed to continue cooking this way into the future. The COVID pandemic also has us all taking hand washing much more seriously. The percentage of people who say that they're washing their hands at least 6 times a day has almost doubled from pre-pandemic levels. While 20% say they're washing their hands 16 or more times a day, according to a recent survey done by Bradley Corp, which designs commercial washrooms and industrial safety protocols. A large majority of Americans say they're washing for at least 20 seconds, in accordance with the CDC's guidelines, and believe they will keep these healthy sanitizing habits going even after the COVID-19 pandemic is behind us. You're listening to Women's Health on Sight into Sound Radio. You can listen to Sight into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or smartphone, as well as Amazon Alexa and Google Home devices. You can also listen at your convenience on our archives page at sightintosound.org. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. And from Prevention Magazine, Own Your Age, special edition, The Grown-Up's Guide to More Confidence for Fall and Winter of 2020. Fit for Life. The secret to longevity is in staying active. Four older female athletes share what keeps them moving. It's officially time to forget everything you think you know about aging. Your energy will flag, not necessarily. You'll add pounds, avoidable. You'll get slower and weaker, so preventable. That's not just wishful thinking. Exercise can keep you younger longer. One study found that older runners, cyclists, and swimmers have far more muscle mass than their sedentary peers do, meaning When you use it, you don't lose it. Other researchers also found that the telomeres, chromosomes, protective end caps that are a key marker of cellular aging, were about 9 biological years younger in women and men who jogged for 30 to 40 minutes 5 days a week, compared with those of their couch-surfing peers. Everyone needs a little motivation to keep moving sometimes. That's why we asked 4 athletes over the age of 80 to share their insights and advice on staying active. Their stories show us what's possible in the second half of life. The swimmer, Joan Campbell, 89. While attending one of my daughter's swim meets, I noticed that there was a master's division for my age group. My daughter said, "You've been watching us kids compete for years. It's about time you participated." I'd never been an athlete, but I'd known how to swim well since I was a child, so I figured, why not? I signed up for a race taking place that day, and to my great surprise, won the 200-meter breaststroke. I was hooked. I joined a master swim team at the YMCA, lost 10 pounds over the next 6 months without changing my diet, and gained tons of energy. Now I'm active in the U.S. Masters Swimming Organization and compete at least once a month. Every week, I train by doing 4 1.5-mile swims at a local pool, 3 40-minute walks, 2 aerobics classes, and 2 sessions of YouTube yoga for swimmers. People always ask me, "Don't you get tired?" But exercise gives you so much zest. I rarely need a nap, and I can keep up with my 5 grandchildren. When my 2 great-grandchildren were born, my baby gift to both of them was a swimsuit. I started late, but they don't have to. Joan's Stay Young Secrets. Always have a goal. It can be anything that motivates you. For me, that's focusing on a long-term challenge, like an upcoming race. Goals give you a push. Avoid scale creep. If my pants start feeling tight, I cut my portions. Fish and fresh vegetables are my go-to dinner. Just say yes. I try to see daily exercise as automatic, so I don't question it. On mornings I don't feel like getting out of bed to swim, I motivate myself by thinking about how good I'll feel afterward, and that always helps get me moving. The track and field star, Florence Miller, 85. I was 60 and a competitive tennis player when my friend Barbara, who worked for the Vermont Senior Games, made a suggestion. "You should take up long jump." I laughed. Even though I'd been active throughout my life, I'd never done track and field. But Barbara was persuasive, so I decided to give it a try. That first year, I competed in 3 events, long jump, high jump, and shot put. Now I do those events plus a few more, but my favorite is pole vault. When I was 65, I saw a few women doing it at the National Senior Games. I thought, gee, I bet I can go higher than that. So I found a coach. He told me that pole vault is the most difficult event I could possibly take up. I wasn't intimidated in the slightest, and I took to it quickly. My abs were strong from years of water skiing, and I think that helped. I added hammer throw to my events in my mid-70s. I've injured myself from time to time. 8 years ago, I ended up with 10 stitches in my left leg after hitting a hurdle. But trying new things keeps me young. It's true what they say. Age is a mindset. As long as the Lord gives me my health, I want to keep this up. Flo's Stay Young Secrets. Discover your thing. It could be water aerobics, yoga, or Tai Chi. The key is finding the activity you like enough to commit to it on a regular basis. Team up. Exercising with friends keeps you on track and motivated. The National Senior Games motto is fitness, fun, and fellowship, and that says it all. Believe in yourself. We are all capable of far more than we think we are. Instead of saying, I can't, say, I'll try. Those words can make all the difference. The Iron Woman, Ruth Heydrich. I started running in 1968 when I was 33 after reading Kenneth Cooper's bestseller, Aerobics. But I had no idea how vital fitness was to my life until I faced tough physical setbacks. At 47, I was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. I was determined not to let cancer slow me down and kept running, even after surgery to remove the tumor. Then I joined a clinical trial that focused on healing my body through a vegan diet and decided to take my fitness up a notch. I heard about the Ironman Triathlon, a 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, and 26.2-mile run, and I started training for it. 2 years later, at age 49, I competed in my first of 6 Ironmans, cancer-free. My ability to exercise was tested again when I was 63, this time more severely. I was hit by a truck while cycling. I sustained multiple fractures in my left leg and right hip, and doctors told me I'd never run again. When I left the hospital, I did physical therapy 5 days a week. Today, I'm still running, although my pace is slower than that of many walkers half my age. It's part of my daily morning routine, along with an hour of cycling and 20 minutes of swimming. My path hasn't been easy, but I'm proof that with effort, you can push past physical obstacles and stay strong, slim, and healthy at any age. Ruth's Stay Young Secrets. Appreciate what you can do. Whether it's walking a half mile or doing chair yoga, applaud yourself. I sometimes get frustrated that I can't run as fast as I used to. Then I say to myself, wait a minute, you're 84 and you're running and cycling and swimming. And suddenly I feel like celebrating myself and my age. Go meatless. I went vegan while recovering from cancer, and it was the single most important health change I've ever made. I don't take any medications. My blood pressure, cholesterol, and blood sugar are perfect, and I weigh the same as I did in my 20s. Focus on the rewards. Exercise helps you sleep more soundly, lower your blood pressure, reverse type 2 diabetes, prevent and reverse heart disease and osteoporosis, and maintain an active sex life and a lean, toned body. What could be better than that? The Yogi, Alice Rocky, 83. As a dance major in college, I studied anatomy, physiology, and kinesiology. In my early 40s, I took up Iyengar yoga, a form of yoga that emphasizes alignment, and I loved it. Eventually, I began teaching this form of yoga to students at a community college. I love showing younger people that you can be fit at any age and that it's never too late to keep learning. In my late 70s, I studied for a month in India and did 2 hours of yoga every day. It's easy to become stagnant as you age, but if you continue to improve physically and intellectually, you never really feel old. I still challenge myself, but my approach has changed. When I was younger, I'd religiously practice a pose I was trying to conquer. It was so ego-centered. Now it's more about what my body needs. I think of yoga as my medicine cabinet. If my back or knees feel achy, I do poses to relieve the pain. There are a few postures I can't do anymore, like a full